The following program is brought to you by We Are Many. To learn more about this program or to find others like it, check out wearemany.org.
So thanks everyone for coming out to this talk today. The motivation for it was fairly straightforward. As many of you may know, the radicalization going on today in the United States is sharpest among young people. Some surprisingly high number, like 80 to 85% of young voters, say voters below the age of 25, voted for Bernie Sanders, a self-described socialist in the Democratic primaries. And that, I think, is just a very early indication of the kind of politics that we can expect to see among American youths moving forward. And this chapter of history that I'm going to talk about today is a fairly little-known story of student and youth rebellion in the United States. It's something that we're hoping we can reclaim so that you can lead the next student insurrection in the years and decades to come. There's a common stereotype about American students, and that is that they, unlike their counterparts in South Africa, Chile, Quebec, are not capable of rising up and making strong political interventions in society. And there's a lot of evidence to support this. If you look at the last, say, half century of US history, but there are moments in the story of this country where students have played a very radical and politicizing role. The best known example is, of course, the 1960s, when students were a major part of the anti-war and anti-racist struggles. But the period that I'm going to talk about today, the 1930s, is much less known. I'm not exaggerating when I say, as you'll see during the course of this talk, that during the 1930s, a student movement with a communist and socialist leadership literally shut down the entire institution of higher education in the United States multiple times throughout the middle of the decade, mobilizing more than half of the undergraduate student population in student strikes against US imperialism and European fascism. So this is a kind of environment that would be very unfamiliar to most of us who have attended school in the United States today, but it was a really vibrant, politicized, anti-capitalist student movement in the United States during the 1930s. And my objective right now is to try to understand why that happened, how that happened, and on the flip side, why it fell apart. Because the unfortunate reality is that within the span of only a couple of years, this movement went from a major force in like US culture to a very sectarian and isolated series of groups that really couldn't mobilize anyone at all. So I'm also going to try and explain that and cull the necessary lessons from it. The first thing, the place to start with this is to understand that the student rebellion is really a reaction to a profound and thoroughgoing crisis of capitalist society, which is the Great Depression. Many of you will know that history somewhat, but beginning with the crash in 1929, US capitalism and the global capitalist system, for that matter, suffered really tremendous shock. There was soaring unemployment, reaching levels of 25% and higher in the US for many years. Large swaths of the means of production in this country lay idle, unused. US workers and much of the US middle class suffered really tremendous hardships, and all sorts of questions were thrown into the air at that time about whether or not the system in which people lived was worth defending and whether or not there was some alternative that could be fought for and won. And that's the context in which the student movement emerges. So this, the accomplishments of the radical left are impressive, but they would have been impossible without that kind of underlying crisis dynamic tearing, literally tearing the country apart, while while the ruling class tries to patch together some type of response through social legislation. Keep in mind as well that the preceding decade in the 1920s had been a decade of deep social, economic, and political inequalities that had also frustrated a lot of workers and young people leading up to the crisis. So people already, you know, hurting before the 1930s began. In some ways, you can draw parallels between those circumstances and our own today. We live it during the fallout of a profound economic crisis and the recovery, which the Obama administration and others have been touting, is a very meager one with difficult consequences for ordinary people. With that said, though, I should also add that news commentators claim regularly that social inequalities today are at similar levels as they were in the 1920s and in beforehand in the so-called Gilded Age. So there are parallels, and I think we, as radicals, revolutionaries, people interested in a different type of society, will be able to position ourselves to respond to those crises now and in the future. But the extent of all these dynamics in the 1930s is much more extreme. We did not have 25% unemployment coming out of the Great Recession a few years ago. So that's the background. Now, student activists on the campuses in the early 30s made a very conscious decision to try to organize on colleges across the country, not just to fight against injustice and to advocate for human rights, for workers' rights, and all the rest of it, but to try to organize students self-consciously as students to intervene in society. And I think this is an idea which, for most of us who've been student activists in the past, might be unfamiliar. But I think it was a really good one and very applicable to our own, in fact, even more applicable to our own circumstances than it was to them. And I'll try to explain a little bit about that. One, the campuses, institutions of higher learning, are places which can have a profound effect on political life off campus. It can set a tone for the kind of political discussions and conflicts which are on people's minds. And students, especially radical students in the early 1930s, understood that and learned that through experience. The second thing is that schools are actually very important institutions for the maintenance, for the reproduction of the society that we live in. They train and they form and mold the next generation of managers, workers, rulers. Everyone has to go through that system in order to come out of it and perform the functions that are required of us for the perpetuation of this society. Students came to learn that as well, and that by contesting the politics on campuses, that they could actually wield, exert real power, and leverage that power to win demands and change the course of history. That's also very important. I'll talk later a little bit about how the students were also aware of the fact that their power was limited and that the main agent of social change, the kind of transformative change that we want to see, was the organized working class. And the solidarity that they built with that class, especially in the mid-1930s in the United States, was very, very impressive. So I'm now going to go through some of that history for you. In 1932, 5% of all U.S. residents who were 25 and over had a college degree. That's not a very high percentage of the population. 10% had attended college at some time or another. The comparative figures for today are 40% of folks 25 and over have a college degree in the U.S., and it's over 50% the number that have attended college at some time or another. So, you can imagine if the students were able to have such an impact in the 1930s, imagine what the impact might look like today if they were national student organizations that were really, causing some trouble, shall we say. It would be profound. There were two groups of young radicals on campuses, mostly in the major urban centers, that were trying to organize during this period. And they were affiliated with the communist and socialist parties in the United States, respectively. And I want to say a little bit about them. So one was the Young Communist League, and the other was the Young People's Socialist League, whose members are often referred to as the Yipsels, which is a term I always enjoyed. Now, a little bit about these parties, because we have to unpack them a bit to try to understand the events on the campuses. The Communist Party is a mass political organization which does a lot of significant work in labor, and most impressively during this period in fighting black oppression, fighting against racism. Unfortunately, it is at this point dogmatically tethered to the foreign policy and politics of the Soviet Union, which had already been converted into a bureaucratic class society with its own priorities separate from workers and the oppressed internationally. And that produced all sorts of distortions and top-down leadership structures within the Communist Party that will play a decisive role in this, and a very tragic role in this story. I'll just put that out there so you know what to expect. The Socialist Party is a much more heterogeneous organization with a lot of different political tendencies that varied historically throughout the early 20th century. You can characterize it as a party with a kind of reformist vision to combat capitalism's injustices and wield the power of workers to pass legislation that will contain and curtail capital. And it had a lot of very talented organizers in its youth sections, just as the Communist Party did. The first step in this revolt is actually all the hidden work that went into building circles of radicals on the campuses during the 4, 5, 6 years before the Great Depression. So there were youths associated with the Communist and Socialist Party who led discussion circles, who talked about politics, who got involved in struggles when they could under very difficult circumstances. They could not openly present themselves as communists or socialists because they would be repressed by college administrations. So they chose different names. Communist youth on the campuses started clubs called social problem clubs, and the Socialist Party also had a kind of front organization of a similar name. And they mostly hosted meetings and talked about stuff going on campus and injustices occurring in wider society and try to recruit people and radicalize people that way. The early breakthroughs of the student movement happened in New York City, and the activists who lead it are drawn from populations of working class, immigrants, first, second, and third generation, predominantly from Russia, Eastern Europe, and Western Europe, many of them of a Jewish background, who were already either steeped in or familiar with radical and socialist and communist and often anarchist traditions. So there was a kind of radical milieu existing in a lot of neighborhoods in Brooklyn, Manhattan, among the working class, out of which the students in the municipal school system came. And those were the students who began the organizational expressions of the student movement in the 1930s. And it's important to recognize that. Let's see. I want to pause briefly and tell you that there's very little written about this, unfortunately. There are a couple of reasons for that. One is that after decades of McCarthyist persecution and smothering of the history of the left, some stories are just very hard to learn about. That's one aspect of it. The other is, as you'll find out in a few moments, the main kind of campaign of the student movement in the 30s was to stop another US imperialist war from taking place. Now, most people in this country, including most of the left, remember the war that came a few years later, World War II, as a righteous and just war. And so the student movement just doesn't fit neatly into that narrative, even though there's never been a bigger student movement in the history of the US. So that's another major reason. If you want to read up more on it, this is the place to start. It's a book called When the Old Left Was Young by Robert Cohen, who's a left liberal historian. It's intensively researched and very enlightening, but it's a little academic and slightly boring to read, and also his conclusions are, I think, totally wrong. So we need our own writing about this, and hopefully some of you can take that up. There's also first-hand accounts by some of the activists but they're it's hard to penetrate them sometimes. So, and that's about it. The reason why he called it When the Old Left Was Young is that a lot of the figures who would come to be major players in the institutional left in the, during the subsequent decades were trained in this student movement. The person who I'm going to speak about in a second, Harry Magdoff, who was played an essential role in building the student movement in New York City, he went on to be a very major Marxist figure in the U.S. and edited the a key magazine called the a key journal called the Monthly Review, which his son continues to edit to this day. And although there are disagreements between their traditions and ours, it's a very significant publication that we have to familiarize ourselves with. The only other person who I'll try to bring out, who played a big role on the left during subsequent decades, is Hal Draper. And Hal Draper, who was a Yipsel at the time, or a member of the Young People's Socialist League, he ended up becoming one of the most important theoreticians and practitioners of the revolutionary Marxism that that has informed and shaped our own organization's practice. Coining, for example, the concept of socialism from below and writing a lot about the self-emancipation of the working class. He was the most important organic link between the student movement of the 30s and the student movement of the 1960s. And it was his idea to tell one of our comrades who's actually speaking about him during this conference in Berkeley in a couple of decades later that the way to win free speech reforms on that campus was by getting the students to go out on strike. And that's a direct lesson from 1930. So, it's great that that's a part of our tradition. So, with all that said, Harry Magdoff is at City College in 1931, right? And he and his group, the Communist Front Organization, which is called the Social Problems Club, has just published a new edition of their magazine called Frontiers, in which they demand the abolition of the Reserve Officer Training Corps, the ROTC, on the campus at City College and criticize it as an organization to build U.S. imperialism. They're all immediately suspended, the charter of their group is revoked, and they're at a loss to know what to do. But they respond very quickly. They form with fellow activists and people that they meet for the first time on campuses across the city a anti-censorship committee, as they called it. And they used that committee to start a petition and to try to raise support for their cause, claiming that the president of City College, Frederick Robinson, who is a real, I mean, any expletive you want to use, this guy will fit it, they accused him of violating their free speech rights and their political freedoms. And they used that strategy to try to build support from sectors of the liberal and left-wing intelligentsia and political figures from that milieu. They ended up getting 10,000 signatures, and with that, threatened to go on to get the student body at City College to go on strike. And they built that, dodged police around the campus, and tried to agitate as much as they could. When the Board of Trustees at City College heard about this, they made the decision that they just wanted to avoid a confrontation. They didn't think that this little social problems club was significant enough to give them the kind of audience that they were gaining. So they decided to go over Frederick Robinson, the president's head, renew the charter, pardon the students, bring them back to campus, and essentially try to neutralize and take the wind out of the movement's sails, because they saw what was coming. Now, the students were very surprised that they had actually won and been and were able to return to campus. So, and they realized that what they had done was very, very effective. They put free speech and political freedoms at the center. They threatened to go on strike, and the first thing they did was go try to organize students from other campuses in the city. And they said, "We are onto something here. Let's try and formalize this." And to do that, they built a new organization out of the anti-censorship committee called the New York Student League, which immediately attracted recruits from around the city, not just from the municipal schools, but also from Columbia University, Barnard, and several other campuses associated with that umbrella institution, Columbia. And through all these discussions, in winter of 1931, they decided that they were actually going to try and go national and build a national student league. So they were quite ambitious, shall we say, in their goals. But it paid off. The first thing that they decided to do after they founded a national student league, which at this point was still based in New York, was to try to organize a labor solidarity trip down to Kentucky. Now, you might say to yourself, well, that seems like a very odd decision from a student league in New York City. But it actually had a certain logic to it. They wanted to raise the profile of the organization and attract a layer of serious activists who were willing to take a week off school, go down to Kentucky, and support an important strike going on there. In Harlan County, Kentucky, the coal miners had been out on strike for months and were being severely repressed by the state. Students in New York agitated around that, managed to fill up a bus with Communist Party funds, traveled down to Kentucky. They were stopped at the border, beaten brutally by Kentucky sheriffs, and then humiliated in a courtroom in Kentucky before being sent home. And their actions, they contributed to a media storm, which raised a lot of awareness about the strike and dramatically rose the profile of the National Student League. Not to mention, it also radicalized everyone who had gone on that trip and made them, permanent activists. So that was the first step in raising the profile of the organization. Then suddenly, different struggles just start to pop up on the campuses in New York City. There's another censorship struggle on Columbia's campus, where the editor of the student newspaper, whose name was Reed Harris, had been suspended for exposing deplorable working conditions of cafeteria workers on the campus. The National Student League, which has a chapter at Columbia, manages to mobilize 2,000 students there, which is the large majority of the student body, to go on strike, demanding the reinstatement of Reed Harris. They win that struggle, which humiliates the long-term president of Columbia, Nicholas Murray Butler, after whom the library is still named today. Then the biggest struggle of all came a year later, when the municipal school system in New York City decided that it was necessary to introduce tuition and a whole series of fees to library use, dormitories, transit to school, and a number of other infrastructures that students, working class students in the municipal system, depended on. This was really the National Student League's moment to shine and become a broader organization that had reach outside of New York. The first thing they did was they made a huge survey to kind of expose the suffering of municipal students in New York City. And then they organized a very successful series of protests and strikes that went on for a series of months, 3 or 4 months. And by the summer, the Board of Education in New York decided to just quietly withdraw the proposal because they preferred to pay that extra money than to continue confronting these rebellious students. And that was an enormous victory. News of that traveled to campuses across the country through new branches of the National Student League that were being created by young communist activists who were already on the other campuses. Within only a month, there's another almost identical victory in Detroit against an austerity proposal in the municipal school system, and that struggle was also victorious. By now, you're really starting to see the emergence of a kind of more nationwide student movement. There are all sorts of other crazy things that happen in New York City. I'd love to tell those stories, and we could talk about them later. Just briefly say, huge anti-fascist demonstrations where the president of City College comes out and starts whacking students with his umbrella. Then thousands of students show up at City College with umbrellas. Just ingenious things. They put on a mock trial of Frederick Robinson, the president of City College, using Communist Party funds again, in the New York Central Opera House with legit prosecutors and defense attorneys and judges and everything. 1,500 people go to that. Frederick Robinson ends up getting fired. Like, the students are beginning to win in a very big way, while elsewhere, the workers are also starting to win some significant victories in the US. And that inspires more student radicalism. Briefly, I just want to say one of the most impressive things to me about the National Student League in this early years is its principled dedication to fighting racism. At the time, there were only 23,000 black college students in the United States. Pitifully low number considering, just a pitifully low and unjust number. There were only 3,000 black students on campuses that weren't designated as all black campuses. Nonetheless, the very first thing that the National Student League decided to do was to organize a conference in New York called the Student Conference on Black Student Problems. That was in 1933, which drew in anti-racist and black activists from all over the country with a focus on the South to talk about racism and the struggle against Jim Crow and segregation, which was a really inspiring meeting and led to a very multiracial leadership in the National Student League, which was highly unusual for the time. And a couple of years later, a new organization called the Southern Negro Youth Congress was built that went into the South to fight against Jim Crow and organize young black workers. They were also severely repressed, and in many ways, their work kind of resembles on a much smaller scale the work of the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee in the 1960s, although their history is just totally smothered. All communist leaders as well. And if you want more info or names about that, we can talk after this meeting. The biggest issue in the student movement was the question of imperialism and war. At the time in the United States, there was a lot of debate about whether or not the US should try to intervene in some of the conflicts beginning to emerge in Europe. And the students were a key force in arguing against US intervention on the basis that all wars which the United States takes up are wars pursuant of its own interests to construct its own empire and expand its own power, that we can never trust the US Army to intervene on the side of justice once it had become a bona fide imperialist force. And, you know, there was a lot of truth to that. 17 million people had died in World War I, and the students wanted to avoid that at all costs. The first action that the National Student League took to try to build a organization of national scope was to host a National Student Conference Against War in Chicago. I'll just flag this and say that it seems to be a pattern on the American left that if you want to build national organizations, basically have to host your meetings in Chicago or around Chicago. So that's something to get used to. Now, this really struck a nerve among students. This was one of the first times when the National Student League and the respective socialist group, which was called the Student League for Industrial Democracy, worked in tandem, actually defying the orders of their leadership. The Communist Party at the time behaved in a very sectarian manner towards the Socialist Party. And the Socialist Party was highly dismissive of the Communists, but the students in both groups recognized the need for a kind of united force to continue waging this struggle. And they encouraged the creation of student chapters throughout the country to take a pledge against fighting in any future US imperialist wars. Critically, that pledge also included a commitment to fighting against all forms of racism and fascism. So there was a radical student culture being built out of that during 1933. Between 1934 and 1937, these students organized annual national strikes against war. Those were the kind of defining and pivotal contribution of the movement. The numbers and the estimates vary, but what we know is that more than 500,000 of the 1.1 million students in the United States at the time went out on strike all on the same day, every year, for 4 years. which is incredible. I mean, it had an enormous impact and provided the kind of main impetus for anti-war, anti-imperialist politics during the 1930s. College administrations, thank you, college administrations freaked out. This was, in their eyes, an enormous threat. They knew that the U.S. would be involved in many wars in the future, and that the consent, or at least passive kind of obedience of the youth was absolutely essential to that. And they were very conscious of this reality and tried to combat the movement in any way they could, including by using startling and frightening forms of repression. The FBI had a, you know, prolific surveillance program targeting students all around the country. I'll just give one example briefly, which is at the University of Chicago. In a four-year period, the FBI opened up 2,000 separate files on students at the University of Chicago. Campus administrators throughout the country set up kind of surveillance rings, which brought in sheriffs, the National Guard, the military, FBI, CIA, to surveil students and try to build criminal cases against them for all sorts of, you know, crimes and infractions, which they thought could get them at the very least off the campuses. The most common tactic used in repression of these strikes was suspension and expulsion, and revoking the charters of student clubs. The administration used a lot of arguments to justify this, which some of you may be familiar with. One was a kind of like parental argument, which is that we love our students, but college isn't the place for them to be kind of, you know, raising hell and going out and protesting. They're here to learn from experts, you know, how to make informed, and sometimes they use the language of critical decisions in the world, and that they have to focus on that. There was a kind of parental justification. Then there was the justification which sounded kind of like, we believe in free speech, but in order for there to be free speech, there has to be a kind of a code of conduct which everyone should follow. And suddenly codes of conduct start springing up everywhere, which say that you know, you can only rally if you're not disturbing classes going on. Of course, the class is always going on, so when are you supposed to rally? And all sorts of other restrictions on student political expression. Then the last one, which was especially prevalent among the most kind of militant administrators, was this kind of anti-communist crusader ideology. The communists are coming to our campus. We have to protect our institutions of democracy, otherwise they're going to destroy the country, which was actually quite prevalent, not just in the South, not just in Texas, but also in California. Frederick Robinson from City College, he was all about that. So those were the different kind of arguments that they used. And they persistently combine repression on the one hand with like attempts to neutralize and co-opt the movement on the other. And they were very strategic about this. But what they found, the main problem was that severe repression led to an expansion of the struggle because it angered students, and attempts to neutralize or kind of co-opt or make compromises with the movement just increased the confidence of the students and their desire to struggle for more. So once momentum had been established, neither tactic really worked, and the campuses were shook for a while. It even threw up the question to students, and I think this is very significant for us: what exactly is a college administration? Why is it there? So they figured out very quickly, well, it's not there to hire faculty or to admit students, because administrators don't know about that. It's academics and the students who can tell you best who the right teachers are, who the right students are for a particular course or a particular academic venture. So obviously the administrators can't be experts in that. Well, then are they managing and organizing the campus? Well, clearly that's not the case, because there's an entire workforce doing that, an entire kind of lower level managerial workforce doing that as well. So what the hell are the administrators doing on the campus in the first place? And a lot of students start to ask that question. And what they realize very quickly is that, well, it's actually clear. The administrators are there to enforce the needs of our society's rulers, to make sure that the content of the education that we receive conforms with the prevailing injustices and inequalities in society. That's why they're there, to control us. And when students started to realize that, it had a very radicalizing effect throughout the country. California, 1934, that's the next big kind of explosion of struggle. While this explosion is happening, there's a general strike in San Francisco, and there's an insurgent socialist electoral campaign by Upton Sinclair with the name of End Poverty in California, all happening at the same time. And while this happens, students at UCLA decide that they want to create an open forum, which just meant a place where the whole student body could congregate and give speeches about anti-war, about the Depression, about Upton Sinclair's campaign, and how to interpret all of this. The vice president and provost of UCLA, his name was Ernest Moore, was also totally freaked out. I mean, I think he was even hyperbolic about the threat. He wrote to the head of the UC administration, his name was Sproul, quote him now, "I fear that this may be the beginning of revolution. It ought to be put down definitively because a general strike, as the one in San Francisco, will lead to civil war throughout California, a form of defiance and struggle which does not belong in a civilized society. The impending overthrow of our government is a real possibility." So, wow. Imagine you're the head of your campus saying that. So the student, he sends the cops out to disperse the students at one of these open forums, right? And a cop comes up and brutally removes this young speaker from the podium who's giving an anti-war speech, begins to drag her off. And in response, this is one of the most militant moments of the movement, the students basically beat up this cop and throw him into the bushes. 3,000 students. And that the realization that they could actually defend themselves like that from a predatory police officer was also a very radicalizing moment, shall we say. In response, the National Guard came. They really repressed that rally as much as they could and dispersed it. But that just contributed to a domino effect that suddenly Berkeley's out on strike, Irvine's out on strike, and the campuses across California start to go through a kind of insurrection, and the key demand that they're making is students deserve a right to free speech and the right to political expression. And I think that that is really profound, that a communist and socialist-led movement was at the kind of vanguard of demands for free speech, and they stuck to that in a very principled way, the idea that every individual has the right to express themselves as they wish and to shape their lives as they wish, and that no one can deny them that right. And also critically, that it's workers and students and the oppressed that are the only social force in society which will consistently defend that right against the machinations of the capitalist class. That was clear. That politics was out there. One student at Berkeley said, when he was asked by a reporter what he thought of the different political forces in the struggle, he said, "If there's one thing I've learned, it's that if you are for freedom of speech, then you are a communist." And I think that's a politics that we want to bring back, that we're the force about freedom of speech, and they are the ones who are always denying it to us. Okay, I just need about 5-10 more minutes. Is that all right? Okay, so I'm going to have to skip over a couple of things. I just want to say that one element of the story which I haven't been able to give justice to, and which unfortunately it seldom appears in this book, is the work that students did to mobilize in solidarity with the labor movement. So every campus where there was a chapter of the National Student League or the Student League for Industrial Democracy was always aware of strike activity that was going on around it and was mobilizing around it. So that that campus was electrified by the strike, and the students were forced to take a position one way or another. Students typically fell in line with workers. That wasn't because these were working class campuses. In fact, the majority of the students at this point were from middle class families, small business owners, doctors, lawyers, managers. But even they had been hit by the Depression and were radicalizing. And the students of the bourgeoisie proper, they faced a choice. They could either deny this reality or confront it full force. And actually, most of them went to the side of the radical left. So I just have to say that. There are all sorts of specific stories about that, but the Students went out on the picket lines. They were often the first ones to be beat up by the cops. They went out there when there were injunctions against workers and actually continued strikes in some situations, so that in many areas of the country, employers and local governments came to know that the students were a factor in the labor movement that you had to take stock of. One very brief quote is that, oh, I actually don't have it here, but there's a judge in New York who said, who basically, after the arrest of 100 students outside of the Orbach's picket line, Orbach's being a big department store of the era, said, listen, kids, you have to stay in school and let the strikers take care of their own affairs, which got a very rowdy, militant response from the kids in the courtroom. And I thought that was a great illustration of what they accomplished. Now, by 1935, this National Student League had about 5,000 members, and the Student League for Industrial Democracy, the Socialist Front Group, had 4,000 members, and that's pretty impressive. But they wanted to expand that radicalization even more. What they decided to do was to form a broader coalition organization called the American Student Union that would permit people from many different kind of political stripes and tendencies to enter into it and take leadership roles in the organization. I just want to touch upon that in the last section of my talk, because I think it's an important question for us. How do you simultaneously build big organizations that can take leadership over reform struggles, but also have principled and explicitly revolutionary currents within it that can try to recruit and expand their influence? I think that building broad organizations like the American Student Union was an intelligent idea, but it's also necessary to have to make sure that within those fronts there's space for revolutionary organizations to clarify their differences, to state their project, and to try as much as possible to reach out and recruit new people in order to deepen the radicalization and prepare much wider layers of students and workers to take militant action against the system. A few comments about how this all degenerated. Unfortunately, by the time the American Student Union was founded, communist students were no longer really interested in radicalizing the student body. And that was because of a variety of factors. The main thing is that in 1935, while all this is happening, the leadership in the Soviet Union decides that it now has to focus the energy of all of its affiliate parties preparing for war against Nazi Germany, which they began to saw as a real threat. So the line which they came up to do this was called the Popular Front, which basically dictated that communist parties throughout the West had to accommodate to and join in alliances with the liberal sections of the ruling class in order to encourage people to accept going to war against the Germans. That was the basic line. And in the United States, this had a series of disastrous consequences. The first was that that because the students were now told to approximate to join in alliances with the liberal sections of the ruling class, that motivated them to kind of swallow their criticisms of a lot of the most vital issues that they had been addressing. So their emphasis on anti-racism just was, in many cases, thrown by the wayside in order to preserve this coalition. Their defense of labor as well was sacrificed, and these students ended up supporting the no-strike pledge during World War II, through which the government cynically used the war as an excuse to try and suppress the labor movement, using all sorts of incorrect justifications. But most importantly, the communists, who are now the dominant faction in the American Student Union, tried to steadily turn the anti-imperialist movement from an anti-war movement to a war-to-end-all-wars movement, which would actually accept going to fight in Europe, which would stop criticizing the Reserve Officer Training Corps, and actually enter the Reserve Officer Training Corps in some periods. And this was really, it has to be unpacked a little bit. The primary reason for this was a kind of allegiance to the Soviet Union. But another reason for it was a genuine fear of European fascism and a sense that it had to be prioritized over the kind of lesser evil of like Western liberal governments. This was further animated by the fact that several hundred American students went and fought in the Spanish Civil War. Many of them died there, and they were kind of sanctified by the student movement in the United States. They too swallowed their criticisms of the fact that the Spanish Republic actually clamped down on the workers' movement in Spain, which they were more afraid of than Franco's fascist armies. Not to mention that they failed to grant Morocco independence when much of Franco's troops were drawn from the Moroccan population. So they swallowed all of those criticisms in order to continue that policy. And I think that there was important dissent within the student movement at this time, led actually by Hal Draper, who again is one of the a key political figure for us, who argued that actually fighting fascism doesn't mean that we have to kind of swallow our criticisms of U.S. imperialism. They tried to articulate a different line. And I think that's very important for us today. It is actually possible to continue criticizing injustices of U.S. and British and French governments during the lead up to World War II, and in fact during World War II itself, from the dropping of the atomic bomb in Japan to the genocidal and orchestrated famine in Bengal, India by the British, which kills many people, which killed millions of people, to the internment concentration camps of the Japanese in the United States, to the U.S. decision to fight against the Greek partisans in Greece who had just kicked out the effing Nazis, the same and a similar decision in Vietnam, the carpet bombing of Dresden, not to mention the fact that the Soviet Union was by this point an imperialist force, which had occupied Poland and Finland. So there were all these criticisms which had to be made in order for us to build an independent alternative political force, which the students at this point decided to abandon, and that was a real mistake. We can talk more about what anti-fascist policy would have looked like for the revolutionary left during World War II, but I think that just swallowing their criticisms was an enormous mistake, and there's a lot more to be said about that. The final coup de grace, if you will, the destructive blow which just contributed to the absolute decline of these organizations was came in 1939 when the Molotov-Ribbentrop Pact was signed, which allied Hitler and the Soviet Union. They partitioned Poland together and basically signed a peace treaty. The communist students had spent years kicking out the socialists from the American Student Union and the American Youth Congress, which is another organization that could be the topic of a different talk, so that they had domination over these organizations. And by this point, they had concealed their identity as communists. They were less interested in recruiting people as they were in making sure that these organizations obeyed the Soviet Union's foreign policy. And they had encouraged people to prepare for a war to fight fascism in Europe. And on a dime, they just switched their perspective completely and begin to criticize Roosevelt as the main fascist and, you know, the US, Britain, and France as the major threat. And students were just bewildered. And the American Student Union literally, it dwindled and then almost disappeared in a very short period of time. 1941, once Hitler invades the Soviet Union, they switched their line again. But by that time, none of the American students were even listening. And I can't overemphasize enough the effect that this had. We went from a period of hundreds of thousands of students striking and building an independent movement to one in which there were no student mobilizations whatsoever. And many of the people who participated in that went and were killed in the war that came. I'm not saying necessarily that it was wrong to send to try to organize to go fight fascism militarily, but there are ways to do that where you retain your own independence as the working class and as students, and you allow yourself to voice criticisms of all sides in the war while fighting fascism. I think many will conclude from this that being tied to a revolutionary party and being tied to a kind of big political project is too risky for the success of the student movement. And there's a lot of tendencies in that direction today, where you shun like grand political narratives, or you frown at political parties being involved in movements. But I think that's the wrong conclusion to take from this experience. it was precisely the big expansive political questions that were most motivating and politicizing for the students in the 1930s. And actually, having an organized revolutionary party, if it had maintained its principles of working class self-emancipation, would have been a major boon, because we live in a complex, mutating world, and it's necessary to have organization that could try and build the right strategies to confront it and adopt a politics that can actually successfully reach out to new layers of people and convince them of the need to overthrow this system. So that's all I have to say about this really swirling and exciting history. There are lots of questions about methods of organization, about student politics that can be raised, and I hope we can get into them during discussion. Thanks so much for being during discussion. Thanks so much for being discussion.
The preceding program was a production of WeAreMany.org, a website dedicated to publishing radical and activist media that promotes a better understanding of today's world while also putting forward a vision for a better future. We Are Many is a project of the Center for Economic Research and Social Change. To learn more about this program or to find others like it, check out WeAreMany.org.